Well, thank you for inviting me to this really fascinating conference. Stellar pulsations is something I've been interested in for many years. Many of you may know that Richard Townsend was my postdoc before he went to Wisconsin, and we had many great discussions about pulsations, and he tried to teach me about them, but I'm a little bit slow on those kinds of things. And originally we had plans to actually work on the interaction between pulsations and stellar winds, but we got sidetracked with some really great, interesting things on magnetic mass of stars, and I'll mention those a little bit. So I've been asked to talk about physics of stellar winds, and I'm going to talk specifically about winds from hot, luminous, massive stars, mainly because that's what I know mostly about, but I was also told by the organizers that this session would be about higher mass stars, and also the fact that massive star winds are, So massive star winds are much more important evolutionarily than, in terms of steady-state winds than other kinds of winds. So just to start off with the background, I actually started out, I did my PhD thesis on the solar wind. The solar wind is very important, of course, because it blows right past the Earth and interacts with the Earth's magnetosphere. But its mass loss rate is really puny, only 10 to the minus 14 solar masses per year. So even over the 10 billion year lifetime of the sun, it only loses about 0.01% of its mass. This clicker's a little. Now, on the other hand, when the sun eventually become a cool giant, it'll lose a huge amount of mass, maybe tens of percents of its mass. And stars that are a few times the sun will can actually even lose more than a solar mass in their final super winds at the end. I would like to make a distinction here between what we call winds here and what might be called a critical limit for mass loss. For example, Rochlob overflow is a kind of a critical limit, and it's very hard to actually predict from a hydrodynamic point of view how much mass will flow over onto the other star. It's really controlled by the interior conditions that make the star inflate. And likewise, I view the end states of giant stars as being kind of like that. They just get so big, almost all the work against gravity is done by the expansion of the star. Whereas when you go to winds from massive stars, the sound speed is only about a few tens, 20 kilometers per second. Escape speeds on the order of a 1,000 kilometers a second, or at least 600, like the sun is. And therefore, the binding of the stellar envelope is very, very tight onto the surface. And you really have to do a lot of work to lift the material out of the gravitational potential. And gas pressure simply can't do that at temperatures of a stellar photosphere. The reason why the solar corona works to the level that it does is because the solar corona is millions of Kelvin. But it turns out that when you get very massive stars, of course, the luminosity gets very high, and the radiation pressure, the radiation scattering, the momentum of the photons can actually drive away mass loss. And you can get very large mass loss rates, up to a billion times that of the sun or even more. And even in these sort of super wind phases, what we call luminous blue variables, they can approach up to solar mass per year, as occurred, for example, in Eta Carinae in the 1840s. So I'm going to focus mostly on trying to understand the last category. So the first thing we have to do is think about how does radiation work in terms of driving. And the basic point of it is that it's pretty straightforward in some fundamental sense. It's just the mass absorption coefficient times the momentum of flux, which is just the energy flux divided by c, integrated over the spectrum. And that has to balance gravity, overcome gravity. Now, if it was just a pure continuum electron scattering, then you can pull the electron scattering out of there and just calculate the radiative, the total bolometric luminosity. And we have this fact that the ratio of the radiation force on free electrons to gravity just goes like the luminosity to the mass because the radius cancels. And in general, if you scale that to other stars, and plug in the number for the sun, it's only a couple of times 10 to the minus 5. But to other stars, of course, have much higher luminosities. The other point is that the opacity that's relevant is the flux-weighted mean opacity. And if you have, in many cases, if you have lots of other opacity, like lines, you might think you get a lot more opacity, but the flux will tend to avoid it unless there's some mechanism to desaturate the lines, which we'll talk about in a minute. So basically, this is the basic scenario for why what you have to do is overcome gravity somehow. So, of course, as I said, the luminosity of stars increases as the power of the mass And so eventually, even though it's a very small effect for the sun, when you get up to massive stars, it becomes quite relevant. And so when you get to stars close to 100 solar masses, for example, they have to bend over in order to stay under the Eddington limit. And the transition of this parameter being half is the transition between where the radiation pressure is dominated by gas pressure versus radiation pressure being more important than gas pressure. And of course, we had discussions earlier in the week about how this kind of situation could be unstable just because you have a light, a heavy fluid being supported by a light one. So indeed, when you look at the HR diagram, Roberta Humphreys and Chris Davidson came up with this really interesting result that there are essentially no stars above a certain limit called the Humphrey-Davidson limit, and that probably has something to do with an effective Eddington limit. So when you get to stars at very high luminosity, they evolve off the main sequence. They can't really go across the HR diagram. They either have to go through some kind of a eruption phases. There's two kinds of eruptions, these horizontal variations called the Esterhazy variations, and these giant eruptions. Of course, if the star is losing mass as a steady stellar wind, it could just go directly over here to become a Wolf Rayet. And so that's the basic idea, is that mass loss in the upper HR diagram is really important for the stellar evolution. Now, before you get to the Eddington limit, when you're really well below Eddington limit, maybe even only a fraction of a percent of the Eddington limit, you can still get mass loss through the line scattering of light bound to metal ions. Of course, this depends on the metallicity. This has some key differences from free electron scattering. First is that line opacity is inherently a resonant process. And just like when you blow in an open air or blow into a whistle versus blowing in open air, you get a much stronger response when you have a resonance process. But it's very tuned to a certain frequency. So the effective opacity, if you will, the effective gamma for lines can be thousands of times that of free electrons because of the fact that the opacity is so enormous for lines. The problem with lines is they're all the opacity is locked up at a single frequency. And so inside of a static atmosphere, the lines saturate and the photons go around the line. That's why we have absorption lines in stellar spectra. But if you have a wind that can get started, then the lines can desaturate by the velocity gradient. And they pick up a fresh supply of flux and essentially sweep through the flux to get momentum. And so there's a classical theory called Castor-Abbott-Klein. It goes back to the 1970s, where you basically take into account the ensemble of lines that is some power law distribution of opacities with a power law index of alpha between 0 and 1. And that's a mixture of optically thick and thin lines. And this Q-bar parameter is on the order of 1,000. And basically, you just can write an analytic expression for the line force, solve the equation of motion, which is basically inertia, balancing gravity, and there's acceleration balancing, this is just F equals ma, and the radiation force. And the most optimal way to get mass loss from the star is to have these three different things be all the same order. And having them all be the same order restricts you to a certain mass loss, a sort of a maximal mass loss, which can be written as a simple analytic formula given here. And on the other hand, the fact that gravity and that the inertia and gravity have to be comparable tells it that the velocity has to scale with the escape speed. And there's this classical beta velocity law for how the winds go. And when you put those two things together, you get this famous wind momentum luminosity relation. Whoops, sorry about that. Which basically tells you how the mass loss rate will scale with the luminosity. It's typically to some power. And this works so well that you can actually use this as a standard candle in exterior galaxies. You have to account, however, for the different metallicities, because this Q-bar parameter is directly proportional to metallicity. So that's the basic idea for how line-driven winds work. Now, one of the things we want to start to ask is what happens when you start to play with these models and do things to them, kick them, and so forth. And the first thing we might think about, because massive stars are typically pretty rapid rotators, some of them rotating actually very close to critical rotation, you might want to ask what happens when you have a rapid rotation. So here's basically, we had earlier in the week a very nice talk about modifying von Zeipel's a law for gravity darkening, but the basic idea is when a star rotates really rapidly, it becomes oblate. Photons have a harder time getting out at the equator than they do at the poles, so you get a larger flux out the poles than they do out the equator. Now, the key point about this is that then von Zeipel tells you that the flux goes like the effect of gravity, and But the mass flux, but the mass loss rate is proportional to the flux, because basically, if you in that case, because basically the extra power index it cancels for gravity. The gravity is in the denominator, but the flux is in the numerator to a higher power, and the ratio of them two gives you that mass flux goes like the flux, and the flow speed goes like the effective gravity, because it's easier to pull things out of the harder it is to pull things out of the gravitational potential, the more of the overshoot you will have. I always like to say it's kind of like pulling a nail out of a board with a hammer. If you pull, you keep pulling until it finally lets go, and the amount that you overshoot and hit yourself in the eye is if the hammer is really in the board. So that's kind of why the flow speed of a wind is very much proportional to the effective gravity. At the poles, the effective gravity is the largest, so you get the fastest, densest wind out the poles, which is kind of like the opposite of what you would expect. Maybe if you just had a rotating star, you would expect it easier to get mass loss out the equator. But no, von Zipel turns that around and makes it actually a more prolate bipolar mass loss. And so in Eta Carinae, for example, there is this prolate homunculus. This is a picture of Eta Carinae in gray. And now that the fact that it's bipolar might actually be due one of the ideas is that it is a rapidly rotating star that actually erupted in 1840s. But the Eta Carinae's eruption probably can't be explained by line driving, but maybe if we have time, I'll come back to that at the end of the talk. But the key point is that even if not, we can still learn about the current day wind in Eta Carinae, because we can put a slit across the nebula. And this is a nebula that is full of dust, and it scatters light from different latitudes of the star. So effectively, by looking at the absorption of the light from different positions along the slit, you're actually learning about the latitudinal variation of the wind. For example, here is H alpha, and the key thing to learn here is that this little P Cygni type absorption trough on the blue side of the H alpha line is actually stronger and wider and deeper in positions of the slit that are over the poles. So the point is that Eta Carinae has this great opportunity for us to actually look at the latitudinal variation of mass loss of the star, and it seems to indicate indeed that the current day star is actually losing more mass at a higher speed over the poles, which is just what's predicted by the gravity darking model. So the next thing is, how are winds affected by large-scale magnetic fields? Well, one of the things is, if you have a very strong magnetic field, then the wind that's driven up the foot points of the magnetic field is forced to go on both foot points to collide at the top of the loop. And if the star is rotating, then that material doesn't fall back down on the star. Below some radius where the centrifugal force is less than gravity, if the star is rotating below critical rotation, material will fall back down on the star. But above some radius, it'll get trapped at the tops of loops. It can't really flow outward because it's being centrifugally suspended outward. It's being fed constantly by the stellar wind. And so you tend to get this rigidly rotating disk type of structure when you have a very strong magnetic field to channel the wind. And when you do, this is Rich Townsend's beautiful animation of a model that he and I came up with called the rigidly rotating magnetosphere model for a star Sigma or E. And it's actually, as you can see, of course, you can't fly to the star and see. But what's happened basically is the material is emitting an H alpha. And you can't actually, of course, fly to the star and see H alpha like this. But you can look at the observational diagnostics, for instance, the H alpha emission lines, and they vary in a very characteristic way, which actually matches very nicely what you observe from the star. But moreover, every time one of these clouds that sort of at the intersection between the magnetic and rotational equators crosses the front of the star, you get a little bit of a photometric absorption dip. And you can also measure the spectral polarimetry of the magnetic field itself. So in this star, we have all the observables to test this model, and it actually passes. This model actually does an amazingly good job of explaining all three things. I don't have time to go into detail. Now, one of the things that you want to know, though, is what happens when you have a very massive star with a very strong magnetic field, what happens to the spin down of the star, the spin of the star, the rotation rate? And there's this very nice formula from Weber and Davis in 1967, where they took the split monopole from the star and they worked out an analytic formula that the angular momentum loss rate would go like the mass loss rate times the rotation frequency of the star times the radius of the alpha n radius squared. And this formula, it turns out, works very, very well if you just modify it to account for the fact that the field is really a dipole and not a monopole. And you come up with this simple formula for the spin down time from a star. Now, the reason why this is somewhat different than the kind of formula you would get for cool stars, because in cool stars, the magnetic field and the wind are both coupled to the rotation of the star. And as the star is rotating faster, you get a stronger, more vigorous dynamo, and therefore you get a stronger spin down. And so the sun probably spun down much more rapidly in its early ages than it does today. But in these stars, we think that these magnetic fields, these large-scale magnetic fields, are actually fossil fields, and therefore pretty much constant. And the wind itself is driven by radiation pressure that doesn't have much to do with coronal heating. So the point is that the spin down time is pretty much a fixed constant in this case, and you can write a simple analytic formula for it and get an analytic scaling law. And for a kind of characteristic numbers you observe for massive stars, you get spin down times on the order of a few million years instead of billion years like you do the sun, just because the mass loss rates are so much higher and the magnetic fields are so much larger. And so when you look at this table, you see that there are two stars in particular. One is this star Sigmaris that we just talked about, and it has a rotation period of about 1.2 days, and it has a spin down time of 1.4 million years. And then this other star has a spin down time of 0.4 million years, and it has an observed rotation period of 538 days. So when you plug in this formula, if that star was just a few million years old, you could understand why it's such a slow rotator. On the other hand, for this star, because you can actually look at these photometric eclipses, you can actually time those very, very nicely by observations since the 1970s. You can do these observed minus computed diagram to work out what the rotation rate is, and you get the rotation to like 6 or 7 decimal places. But you can also fit the curves. Unfortunately, there was nobody that took data all these years from 1976 to in here. So my student took data over several years at a small telescope in Chile, my graduate student, Mary Oxala. And she and Rich we put the data together to basically measure the spin down time of Sigmaris E. And it turns out to be 1.34 million years, within 0.1 million years of the predicted spin down time that was published 2 years before that. In this paper on magnetic spin down that we did with my student Asif Abdullah. Okay, so now I want to turn to another issue about line-driven winds, namely that they're very, very unstable, and therefore they have lots and lots of clumping. And moreover, the clumping is such that the instability is self-generating. However, if you have turbulence in the wind, it can help seed the instability. So here is the idea that waves from the interior of the star can actually leak through the sonic point. This is actually important from the point of view of stellar pulsations, because it means that instead of pure reflection at the surface, you have some wave leakage into this. But this can actually then seed turbulence in the wind, which causes all kinds of shocks and instabilities. And you get a very, very unstable structure like this. And you see evidence of this in emission lines from Wolf-Rayet stars, that the winds are very, very structured. And then you also see evidence for large-scale structure that might be related to pulsations. And we think that these generate these kind of large-scale co-rotating interaction streams. And I just want to finish up now with a brief description of a nice model that we did for, that my former student, Stephen Kramer, who's now at CFA, did on this radial pulsator, BW-Vol. Because it's a radial pulsator which has a pretty substantial variation in its luminosity and its brightness, that luminosity brightness drives variations in density, which propagate out as waves through the stellar wind. And in particular, there are these flat plateaus. And the flat plateaus give rise to absorption features, which then when you generate the a dynamic spectrum for an ultraviolet line, you get patterns of repeated absorptions, which match really quite nicely with what you see in the carbon-4 spectral spectral lines. Okay, so this is where I was realizing I wasn't going to make it, but I do have a lot of work I've done on the end states of massive stars when they get to be luminous blue variables. But because of the limited time, I'll have to stop there, and maybe we can have some discussions with people who are interested at some point. So let me just skip ahead to the final conclusions, and then we can take the questions. So these are all embargoed, or whatever. Let's see if I can find the conclusions. They are in here somewhere, summary, right there. Well, thank you very much. Mateo? Yeah, somebody needs a, let's see, want me to give him a mic?
Okay, thanks a lot, Stan, great talk. I was wondering, you discussed a bit, very briefly, the occurrence of discrete absorption components in the UV lines of stars. And historically, the big debate was always between what can cause this phenomena, and the debate was always between magnetic fields at the surface or stellar pulsations.
Right.
However, we learned during this conference two things. We knew that one thing, that is that the ducts are ubiquitous, basically are found everywhere in massive stars. Wherever people have looked for them, they found them. Pulsation, on the other hand, it seems to be not ubiquitous in massive stars. In fact, the Kuro observation, which are the best apparently done so far, where they look at the variability with very high precision for those massive stars, they found no pulsations basically there, beside some stellar-like oscillation in one of stars. So isn't this telling us that pulsation is not the cause of ducts?
Well, I don't disagree with you, but I think you have some really interesting cases. This is a B supergiant star that was observed by IUE. I kind of went over it really quickly, but when you do the dynamic spectrum from the star, you see two kinds of features. You see these slow-moving discrete absorption components that move very, very slowly through the line, and you see these very clearly periodic features right here, which we often sometimes refer to as phase bowing or bananas. And those features, I believe, are probably pulsation-related, and these are probably induced by
input.
And there are examples of places where pulsation does play a role. And I think this is one of them that actually has both. That's my own opinion. It needs to be worked out. But Alex Lobel has been doing some nice work on this. And I've done some work on it with Steve Cranmer. That's where this figure came from. And basically, I think the answer is that they're not mutually exclusive. But I think about the ubiquity, I would have to say I lean towards the idea because the discrete absorption components are only quasi-periodic, they're episodic. Whereas when you see a very clear periodicity like this, I think that's more likely linked to pulsations. Whereas the fact that magnetic fields can come and go, the decay time can be comparable to the rotation period, I think it's a reason why discrete absorption components are quasi-periodic instead of periodic. So I think they both operate. And your model, by the way, that talks about bright spots are exactly what you need in order to induce these very dense, extra over-dense structures. But you need to have them be pretty big, I think. So I think there's still some issues about whether we can do it quantitatively. But qualitatively, I think the ideas are very good.
Yes, thank you for this very interesting talk. I'm especially interested in the star Sigma Orionis E and similar stars which are, as you showed, helium strong.
Right.
And in fact, this reminds me, I worked on that very, very long ago about the fact that it's helium strong. And these stars are helium rich only at the surface, not inside. And the only way to explain that, and I think it's still the case now, but the only way to explain that was that helium, there was a segregation inside the wind. I mean, a wind and the segregation helium falling inside the wind or said another way, not living at the same rate as the rest of the wind because of its weight, because of kind of gravitational settling, well, so that you can have an accumulation in the outer layers. And my question was, with all what you know now about the wind, which is much more precise than what we knew several decades ago, have you looked at that? And that may be a constraint on the wind, the fact that you should accumulate.
People have looked at how you get segregation between different elements. For instance, In line-driven winds, everything is dead. The momentum all goes on metals, and the protons and helium are dead weight, and so you can get a separation between the metals and the. But helium is also dead weight because it has very few lines. Yes. Now, I think in terms of the abundances, you know, you have helium strong stars in the early type B stars, and you have a helium weak. Helium strong are probably radially levitated to the surface, to the base of the stellar wind. Or to this, to the atmosphere for that matter. But then when you get to the O stars, I didn't get a chance to talk about this, but there's this great project called MIMES, Magnetism and Massive Stars, which is now dozens of magnetic stars, including a half a dozen O stars. And in O stars, you don't see a very strong signature in abundances. And that's probably because the wind is basically removing abundance accumulations away faster than they can accumulate in the photosphere. So you do see this very clear trend in abundances from helium weak and late type B stars to helium strong, where the helium is probably levitated by radiations, even though it's heavier. And then you see relatively little signatures in abundance anomalies in the O stars. But you now have a half dozen O stars. For instance, that one that had 600-day rotation period that has a 1,000 Gauss magnetic field, or 1,500 Gauss.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I didn't have time to really talk about magnetic massive stars in their full glory.
I was hoping to hear more about what you didn't get to talk about, which was the LBV stars, and I was wondering if you could share what you thought, if what role pulsations might play in launching these super wind phases of LBV stars, if any.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple of issues. One is so when you go to the luminous blue variables, you have really two different kinds. You have these so-called Esterhazy variables, which go back and forth. Okay, and then you have these giant eruptions that are like Eta Carina. And the Esterhazy variations actually can be understood from the iron bump. That basically the iron bump causes an inflated envelope because it's really hard when you get close to the Eddington limit, you add a little bit of opacity, the gas just can't stay hydrostatic unless it gets very low density. And so this is a gas density going down and radiation pressure, gas pressure going down, radiation pressure going down. And that bump basically represents a really low density thing, which means the star has to really become inflated. And so you get, there's actually an analytic formula for the inflation. But here's basically the idea, the star becomes so inflated, this is a tiny amount of mass, but it's still optically thick in the star. And so as the star inflates, it actually moves to the right in the HI diagram, then the mass loss rate goes up because the opacity goes up with the lower temperature, and the envelope basically dissipates. So that's basically the Esterhazy variations. For the giant eruptions, it really comes down to an issue of the fact that they go above the Eddington limit. And why they go above the Eddington limit and what triggers that is a key question. But a key point about Eta Carina is that the energy of its wind is comparable to the energy of its light. And therefore, it's probably true that these winds are basically like little failed winds, once the star gets so luminous, it tries to drive mass, but it can't drive more than a certain amount of mass that's limited by its energy. Now, so what you end up with is a very structured medium. So I'll just skip ahead, kind of like a fluidized bed that we were talking about earlier. And you end up with a very structured medium where the porosity of the medium basically is what regulates the mass loss. And that's the essential essence. Now, it's possible that this porosity could be triggered by things like strange modes and things like that. At this point, you're talking about a star whose radiation pressure is much bigger than gas pressure. And so there's all kinds of interesting pulsational instability physics that one needs to explore at that point. But basically, the fact is that the stars are really pushing up against this limit. And like you say, like I said earlier, limiting flows are kind of much harder to diagnose. I like to use the analogy, like if you're walking, it's easy to talk about how the physics of a glass that's half full and you put your straw in it and you suck it out because you know it's directly determined by how hard you suck. Right, that's basically the radiation force driving things off of a stellar wind. But if you're walking around with a glass that's 90%, 95% full, and you're walking around, every little wiggle that you do makes it spill mass, right? And that's basically what's happening when you're getting to a critical limit. Lots of things can cause it to be triggered so that you have mass. And some of them could be these pulsation modes that people here are very interested in. And I'd be very interested in talking more about that. Thank you for the extra time. That was given that by the the microphone. Yep, don't want to lock around the microphone.
Okay, thanks, Dan. So next talk by Enzo on OB stars seismology.